Ryan, what's been going on?
Ryan filled him in.
Dark night.
On Mildred's recommendation, he didn't try to get out of bed right away, although it was obvious from his restlessness that he was itching to get into action. By the following morning, JB could stand it no longer. Yelling at Dean to help him until the youngster gave in, JB got up and hobbled out of the shack and into the center of the ville, where he sat on an upturned box and watched in disgust as Jack attempted to teach some of the local fighters the finer points of hand-to-hand combat. Even pulling his punches, Jack had in the past hour injured two of them enough that it would take them several days to recover. The armorer pulled his fedora down so that the snap brim shaded his glasses from the ever-present swirl of dust.
Now do you see why Mac was allowed to live, Dean?
I do now, seeing this bunch of stoops. It just seemed weird, 'cause Dad's drummed it into me that you never leave enemies alive. And don't tell me the story of the little girl who ripped out someone's jugular with her teeth, 'cause I've heard that one too many times.
Trader was right, though. Then there's always one exception to any rule. Being too rigid can be as dangerous as being too slack.
Dean knew what the armorer meant as he watched Mac take on Jack. The fat man outweighed the slender Jack by almost double, and was several inches taller. His head was still scarred by the blow he'd taken outside the shack, and from the look on his face, he was expecting to get some revenge in a one-on-one fight.
Ready when you are, Whitey.
They circled each other, watched by the crowd of men and women who were there to learn. The tension grew as they circled, until it seemed that no one in the crowd could draw breath until the first strike. It came from the blue, still unexpected, despite the close attention and anticipation of the crowd. Jack feinted to the left, drawing Mac's attention, then followed up to the right with a kick that took the sec man's legs from under him. Instead of falling heavily, as would be expected, the awkward-looking sec man let himself flop to the ground, relaxing his muscles to avoid the rigidity that broke bone. He rolled as he hit the dirt, out of the range of Jack's follow-up kick. Instead of connecting with his jaw, the albino's foot carved a space in nothing but air. It was only Jack's immense control and balance that stopped him falling flat. Instead, he used the momentum of the kick to pivot, taking him out of range of the thundering roundhouse blow Mac aimed at his body. The sec man was more powerful and agile than he looked, but his notion of fighting was basic. He aimed for the body with a succession of kicks and blows designed to cause maximum damage. Jack avoided all of those with twists and turns of his body, staying out of range and letting Mac expend energy.
Damn it! Sit still! Right, fat man.
Then, when the sec man was puffing and blowing, slowing slightly, Jack darted in beneath one of the blows and delivered a hard jab with his extended fingers, sinking them into the soft flesh above the sec man's ribs.
Oof!
Mac shot backward through the air as though a jolt of electricity had been forced through him. He tumbled over, falling naturally by instinct. Jack stood back, waiting for the sec man to get up.
Bless his ma. I hear you, Whitey.
They closed on each other, circling tightly, neither willing to make the first move. Jack fainted, then lunged. Mac second-guessed him and blocked the straight-fingered blow by trapping Jack's arm in both of his own, crossed to strengthen them. He stepped back, allowing Jack's momentum to carry him forward. The albino sailed past Mac, hitting the dirt face first. Like the sec man, he allowed himself to relax as he hit, but Mac had anticipated that and followed up in the millisecond while Jack was prone and momentarily defenseless. His heavy boot thudded into Jack's face, splitting the albino's lip and causing blood and spit to fly into the dust.
Water the earth, you muty bastard. We're quits.
Mac stood back, allowing Jack to get up. The albino wiped the blood from his face.
Yeah, quits. Learn quick, fat man. Why think I let live? Always a reason to break your own rules, except that it has to be a good one.
Mildred and Christy were given the thankless task of trying to teach the ville dwellers to shoot straight. It seemed almost alien to them that anyone in the Deathlands could survive without any kind of shooting skills. Blasters were second nature to the post-Skydark generations. Nonetheless, the dwellers of this pest hole had few blasters, and they were in poor condition. Most of them relied on explosive power rather than accuracy, and it was dispiriting for a crack shot like Mildred to have to train such an inept group of fighters. So she was glad when J.B. hobbled into the fray to offer his services. The armorer still couldn't get around at great speed, but the ankle was healing as he was resting it. His fever and semi-coma had been beneficial to his damaged ankle, allowing the initial sprain time to mend. The reticent armorer had once again muttered an oath, and little more, when Dean had shown him the tumble-down shack that passed for an armory. His response to taking a look inside had been to moan gently and to shake his head sadly. There wasn't much J.B. could do to assist them. Most of the time he was under orders to do little except sit all day. However, having cursed the way in which the Vildwellers looked after their blasters, J.B. decided that the best thing for him to do would be to try to lick the armory, such as it was, into shape. A small group of women and children gathered around him as he sat on an upturned box, stripping the blasters and polishing them, greasing them as best as he could, and putting them back together. Along the way, he found that some of the blasters were entirely homemade, while others were comprised of separate parts that had been forced and welded together to make a complete blaster. Why these hadn't exploded in the faces of those who fired them was a complete mystery to the man. J.B. cleaned the weapons and explained to his audience why it was important to keep the blasters clean and oiled. He tried to explain to them the concept of different calibration on weapons, the differences in ammo and their respective firepower. His eyes shone behind his glasses, and he didn't notice that some of the women and children looked at him blankly, not understanding him. It didn't matter. He told them all he could, hoping that enough would penetrate to keep the blasters in good working order for the final confrontation. While he did that, Jack and Dean took turns coaching people in unarmed combat. Christy and Mildred tried to improve their shooting. As all this was going on, Ryan was far from idle. The one-eyed warrior had been thinking and planning. He could see that his forces, even swollen by the ranks of the Vildwellers, would be no match for Murphy's men once they were inside the redoubt. Outside, they'd match the well-equipped Sekhmen by virtue of their being adapted to the conditions. Inside, they could hit big trouble. Ryan spent most of his time with Abner, learning all that the old man knew of the redoubt forces, all that he knew of the surrounding terrain. They called in Mac, who'd been in more expeditionary raids on the territory than any other Sekhmen in the Ville. Ryan picked their brains, put forward his plans, making sure that Abner and Mac thought that they'd come up with half the ideas themselves. Finally, the Baron called together his people in the rough ground they called the center of the Ville. He outlined the plan he and Mac had come up with to help the Outlanders. Christy, knowing Ryan, smiled to herself as Abner claimed Ryan's best strategies as his own. It didn't matter, as long as they got the result they wanted. Ryan listened to Abner and looked at the Ville dwellers. They were muties, inbred, and not used to hard hand-to-hand fighting. He felt a twinge of conscience, briefly. Did they realize what they were getting into? It would be difficult, hard, and bloody. That much Ryan knew. But it was necessary, for their long-term survival, as much as that of Ryan and his people. And they were ready. Or as ready as they'd ever be. The worst part was the waiting. Ryan and J.B. stood at night, staring into the darkness beyond the beacon fires that marked the Ville's boundaries.
Hey, J.B., think we're ready to attack those bastards and get our tickets out?
As ready as ever, though that's not saying much.
Either we're outnumbered, or we hope they can pull together long enough. Some choice.
Just don't expect firepower miracles, that's all.
I know. It's enough to make you cry.
Question is, when do we move?
Ryan stared out into the dark, squinting his good eye to try to focus on the swirling darkness. The storms made the night seem like a solid thing he could reach out and touch, like a physical barrier between themselves and the redoubt. In some ways, that's exactly what it was.
Gotta trust Abner on that one. If nothing else, his people know the valley. We have to go with him.
Sure, but excuse me if I get an itchy feeling down my spine when I think of it.
Yeah. Sure be good to move.
Ryan sought out Abner the next morning, coming on the Baron as he was still in the rusty iron bed, with the latest in a long line of girls young enough to be his granddaughter. Hell, for all Ryan knew, they might well be. It wouldn't be the first time he'd come across that sort of sickness. He remembered Baron Willie Elijah and his wives Rooney, Tooney, and Pooney, and their daughters, Rooney 2, Toonie 2, and Poonie 2. They were all from the same wife that Willie had first taken.
Morning, One-Eye. So, what can I do for you, friend?
I was talking to my people last night. We want to move as soon as possible.
I don't know about that, friend Ryan. See, it's got to be the right conditions. Otherwise, my people stand a chance of getting chilled big time.
Ryan pulled the panga from along his thigh, slowly so as not to alarm Abner or the girl. Nonetheless, the long and wickedly gleaming blade made her eyes widen, and Abner looked distinctly uncomfortable. His hand reached under the covers. Ryan began to pare his chipped and hardened nails with the panga, smiling over the top of the blade.
I'd be careful with that blaster, Abner. One day it might go off and blow your pecker clean away. And you wouldn't like that, would you?
Just what do you want from us now, One-Eye?
Oh, nothing. Just a chance for us both to get what we want. And don't worry, I'm not going to try to kill you. I know Mac's back there just itching to put a hole in me.
Mac emerged from the doorway, where he'd had his blaster trained on Ryan.
I like you, One-Eye. You and your people got balls, even the women. Sure learned a lot from you. Still more to learn if you don't get yourself chilled too soon.
I've got no intention of that. All I want is to know when we're going to move.
Can't yet.
Why not?
The storms, Ryan. We get a nose for them here. Guess we have to if we're going to survive. They're always here, but some are worse than others. If you look out east from here, you can see the swirls of dust rise up maybe 20-30 feet into the sky. That means we got some real sons of bitches out there. Whip your skin off you in 5 minutes. Can't move through them at any kind of pace without your legs turning to jelly. No way we'd be in any fit state to fight, even with your training.
Convinced, but keeping a watch on Abner's hand hidden beneath a blanket, Ryan resheathed the panga.
So, Mac, how long do those kind of storms usually last?
Hard to say exactly. The storm ain't rightly a believer in accuracy. It doesn't carry a wrist cron, you know?
Roughly, then.
Maybe a day, maybe a week. This one, I don't know, it might not be a long one. Can't rightly say why, but when the dust gets that high, it usually means that the storm blows itself out pretty quick. Don't hold your breath, though.
Don't fret yourself, Mac. There's no chance of me doing that. Every breath is precious.
Ryan carefully walked out of the shack, past the fat sec man, who shuffled out of the way, lifting the long-barreled blaster to allow the one-eyed warrior to pass. When Ryan was out of earshot, Abner slowly let back the hammer on his blunderbuss.
Bastard outlanders. I'll be glad when that mother and his people are gone. If we're really lucky, the insiders will chill them while they chill the insiders, leaving it all nice and peaceful for us.
Don't hold your breath.
The storm was raging. The wind whipped dust and dirt through the air, which was almost solid with the force of the howling winds. Small stones and pebbles rattled off the reinforced windshields of the wags, bouncing off the metal and canvas covers that Murphy had made his men erect before leaving the redoubt. They had wags that weren't convertible in such a manner, but Murphy, like the Murphys before him, felt safer if his men could see around for 360 degrees. The metal covered in wags might protect them better from the worst ravages of the storms, but they sure as hell didn't help them see outsiders creeping up on them. When the storms lessened, the covers came off. They were only used in the most violent storms. Murphy sat in the lead wag with a group of 5 men, a driver beside him, and 4 men on the bench seats that lined each side of the wag. There were 3 other wags, each with similar personnel, which totaled 24. Not exactly a large task force, but enough for their needs. The outsiders really were stupid, Murphy mused as the wag bounced over the terrain. They never expected a raid when the storms were this bad, despite the fact that it was always the time that Murphy picked. He'd have thought that even the stupidest of them might have caught on by now. It never occurred to Murphy that it wasn't that simple, that the outsiders couldn't see them coming, and that they couldn't mount solid defenses because they didn't have enough old tech to compete.
Bridge coming up, sir.
The dust always got into the driver's, Pry Furclass Bailey's, lungs, making him hawk and spit and fight for every breath. But he was a good soldier and never complained. Murphy admired that. That was why Bailey was one of his chosen few.
Very good. Take it slow as usual.
Sure thing, sir. Not much chance of there being any of that scum around, not in this.
Nah, why else choose a shitty time like this?
Murphy picked up the handset of the crackling radio.
Alpha 1 to Beta Gamma Delta. Praise the Lord. There's a bridge coming to take us to the promised land. Follow the one true path. Don't go for the endless sleep. Over and out.
Murphy put the handset back, only half listening to the crackly and distorted replies from the other three wags. He knew that they would be following orders and following him. He trusted his men implicitly in a combat situation. They knew the penalties for deviation, always assuming that they could get back to base. The bridge across the chasm was camouflaged. Murphy's grandfather had built it about as far away from the old two-lane blacktop as he could, then covered it with a camouflage paint that made it hard to pick out from a distance. He figured that the outsiders always followed the line of the old road, wary of straying too far because of the muddy wildlife. To build the road here made sense, and the camouflage paint was the final touch. Although such paints had already existed in pre-dark times, this was something special.